All right. Well, welcome, everybody. Welcome to our February call. If you're one of the new chapters, I want to particularly welcome you. I'm Mark Reynolds, and I'm one of the people who gets to host this call, which makes me happy. And also, one of those new chapters is in Madagascar. So we started, Kathy Orlando, part of our international team, started a chapter by Skype. I'm hoping we can get the picture out in this week's newsletter of the women in Madagascar who started that chapter, but that's very, very exciting. What's going to be happening in just a moment, I'm going to be introducing our guest speaker, Dr. Celia Paris, who I really believe has a unique angle to present her expertise on that we've never been able to get out on this call. So I'm very excited about that. Before we do that, I would imagine a fair number of you watched the opening ceremonies of the Olympics last night, and I watched a lot of it, and I was actually kind of inspired about watching the North Koreans and South Koreans walking in together. Who knows what will come of that, but it kind of did tug at me a little bit about, wow, maybe something could happen that hasn't been predictable for a long time. But what I wanted to get at with this is, this has probably happened before, but one of the things that's been nice as a lead up to these games is some of the Winter Olympic athletes are talking about the importance of dealing with climate change. And again, that probably has happened, I just haven't seen it, but I wanted to share with you a 2-minute video of some members of our cross-country Olympic ski team who are obviously concerned about the future of their sport. So, Ricky, could you share that quickly, just some of our Olympic athletes speaking up about the importance of doing something on climate change?
Hi, I'm Sumi Hamilton.
Hey, I'm Jesse Diggins.
I'm Andy Newell.
I'm Liz Steven, 3-time Olympian, member of the U.S. ski team. You are ambitious.
U.S. cross-country skiers are resourceful.
Cross-country skiers are fun.
Cross-country skiers didn't get to where we are today by taking no for an answer. Just like we work together on snow,
it's time for us to work together to fight climate change.
I've been a member of the U.S. ski team for the past 16 years. In that time, I've raced over 200 World Cups, and unfortunately, I've seen firsthand the effects of climate change on our sport. In areas like the Midwest, New England, and here in Central Europe, it's becoming increasingly unlikely that we race on fresh snow, and many of our races are held on man-made loops. I am so proud of the U.S. cross-country skiing community that the last thing I want to do is see the next generation of skiers grow up without snow. I'm also proud to say that it's not too late. If you're racing the Berkey this year, look to the left of you, look to the right of you, and think about how powerful we can be in numbers. Think about how powerful the U.S. cross-country skiing community's voice can be against climate change. If you have skis on your feet today and enjoy winter as much as I do, please get involved. You can start by asking your representatives to join the Bipartisan Climate Solution Caucus. And join me in supporting the Citizens Climate Lobby carbon fee and dividend proposal. And also please help by supporting Protect Our Winners at protectourwinners.org. Please remember, cross-country skiing community, we are the power. Our political representatives will answer to our will. There is a solution to climate change, and it's already underway, and we have the power to add to an already growing movement. The future of our sport and our lifestyle and our planet depend on us.
So I thought you might enjoy seeing that as much as I did when I first saw it. And Jesse, who was one of the cross-country skiers, came in fifth in her first race last night. And Paul Thompson told me he's staying up getting up at 1 a.m. to watch one of their races, 1 o'clock Central Time. So anyhow, we're thrilled that those Olympic athletes are out there speaking up, celebrate what they're trying to do. Okay, our guest speaker this month is Dr. Celia Paris. She's the assistant professor in political science at Loyola University. She's currently working on a book manuscript that explores whether Madisonian ideals for deliberative and collaborative political decision-making have lost their appeal. Titled Madison's ABC, The Public Still Values Accomplishment, Bipartisanship, and Civility in Congress, Her book argues that the desire for a more Madisonian approach to politics remains alive and well in the American public, and that citizens value accomplishment, bipartisanship, and civility. Dr. Paris, thank you. It's so great to have you on the call. Welcome.
Thank you. It's an absolute pleasure to be here, and thank you all the chapters, and Mark and Ricky for everything you do. All right, I'm just going to pull up my slides here. All right. So I'm here to talk to you guys today about why it's so important that the work we do is bipartisan and sort of why that's really an advantage when you're talking to legislators about joining the caucus or about supporting carbon fee and dividend. And so I started my research sort of focused on this question of, does the public care about bipartisanship and cooperation across the aisle in Congress? So I'm going to talk to you a little bit today about sort of what I've done with that research and the implications it has for the work that Citizens Climate Lobby does. So we might think people love bipartisanship, right? I mean, people talk a lot about how they want to see more bipartisanship in Washington. They're frustrated that they don't see that. And actually, when you ask people in polls, you say, what should elected officials do? What you end up hearing is that strong majorities really say they want elected officials to cooperate across party lines. They want elected officials to treat each other with more civility, even when they're on opposing sides. And they want elected officials to compromise. So on the one hand, you might think, yeah, it's really clear that the public has an appetite for more bipartisanship. On the other hand, that's really not what we see happening in politics. We sort of see the opposite of that. Obviously, politics is now sort of more polarized than it's been for decades. So legislators from different parties are just much more likely to take the opposite sides of any given issue. But it's not only about the two parties disagreeing more with each other. We've also really seen this rise in partisan warfare. So we've seen more of our members of Congress being willing to sort of say humiliating things to each other, questioning each other's motives, saying, you know, you aren't interested in making the country better or addressing problems. And we've also seen both parties sort of being willing to change the legislative process to suit their needs and to sort of undermine what's going on in Congress. So it's no longer just about defeating this or that bill or disagreeing with a certain bill that passes. But, you know, that's why part of why we've seen so many government shutdowns and so many sort of procedural changes that are just meant to advantage the party who's currently in charge. So given all of this, I think a lot of legislators wonder, and we should all wonder, could reaching across the aisle actually be risky? So have voters really been swept up in this atmosphere of partisan warfare to the point where they think, you know, this is my team and I don't want you selling us out to the other team? So that brings us back to the question of what people actually want. Should we trust what national polls say, or does this atmosphere of partisan warfare mean that, frankly, voters themselves just want really to see their elected officials stick to one side, and that voters might even punish reaching across the aisle? So, spoiler alert, obviously polarization and partisanship is real. Voters are themselves more partisan than they used to be. But even given that, I actually find that people do care a lot about bipartisanship. So they tend to support bipartisan policies. They see bipartisan policies as closer to their own views than when those policies are just supported by the other party. And they're more impressed with legislators who act in a bipartisan way. So what I want to do now is actually take you through some of the evidence I see for those things, so you know where that's coming from, and really can feel confident when you're talking to legislators about why it makes sense for them to be involved in this as a bipartisan effort. So part of the reason why this is even a question, right, is that for many legislators and for many of us, it's kind of ambiguous what the public wants. Even when we have national polling data, that doesn't necessarily tell you how the people in a given district feel about a political issue. And even when we have district level polls, those are much less common. And then even when we have them, they're not as reliable. We saw this a little bit with election 2016, where national polls were pretty accurate in terms of the final outcome. But in terms of the state level polls, they were less so, which led to some unpredicted things happening. Unexpected things potentially happening in the Electoral College. So, and I also want to emphasize that when we're thinking about what the public wants, this ambiguity about what voters in your district might want, that's true for both how they want you to behave if you're a legislator. You're not sure on what they want you, how they want you to treat other elected officials. And it's also true on policy. So this ambiguity is also challenging for us because even when we're looking at ordinary national polls, those aren't always really clear. I mean, one concern we have is that people might be inclined to say the acceptable instead of the true answer. So actually, if you ask people about drug usage on a survey, they're not always inclined to share that information with the person who's taking the survey. So we see that people really underreport that. And we also see that people overreport positive actions like voting. So you see much higher rates of people saying, yes, they voted in the last election than actually voted. And we worry that this might happen with something like bipartisanship, where you say, of course I want them to act in a bipartisan way, but when it gets right down to it, you might not like it if someone from your party is trying to engage in this bipartisan compromise. It's also the case that even small changes in how you ask survey questions can lead to pretty large changes in the sort of attitudes you're seeing people report, especially when you're looking at sort of complicated or technical policies. So this can be true of sort of economic policies, any sort of policy that involves specific trade-offs. It really depends how you ask the question. So it isn't clear that people have really deep attitudes because their attitudes seem to move around depending on what you emphasize. So all of this means that it's really important that we think carefully about how can we clarify what the public actually wants. So there are two big lessons that I think public opinion research gives us. The first is that when Congress is debating a policy or debating a bill, people are really going to use cues to decide how they feel. I'll talk a little bit more about what cues are in a moment. And the second thing is that if we want to know how people really feel about something, it's better to look at how they react to specific examples of that, rather than just ask them globally, what do you think about bipartisanship? And when we look at those reactions, that really gives us much better leverage on what's actually going on with the public and are they willing to reward bipartisanship. So on the first point, on cues, cues matter a lot in part because people often don't have a lot of knowledge about politics and political issues. So they don't necessarily know the details of different possible climate policies. They don't necessarily know sort of important things about how the economy works. They may not even know sort of who's on the Supreme Court or sort of what's happening in Congress, right? Because people are busy, they have a lot going on. But because of this, it means that people are often relying on cues or shortcuts that help them decide which policies they want to support. Some of the most common cues are the position your political party takes and positions taken by politicians that you like or respect. So we see this, for example, when you're looking at sort of supporters of President Obama being willing to go along with policies that he endorses. Same thing for President Trump. So people often use how their party, or what their party supports, or what certain politicians support as a cue for what policies would benefit people like them. Now, this doesn't mean that people's attitudes towards specific policies don't matter. They do, especially if they are strong, if people have a clear, strong sense of what policies they prefer. And also when you give people specific policy information, they will react to that and that does make a difference. But even given that, once a political debate starts about a specific bill, the policy details matter somewhat, but also the cues still matter a lot. How different politicians line up on either side of supporting or opposing a policy, that really means something to people about whether they should also support or oppose that policy. So that's the first lesson that you should keep in mind and you know, I think share with legislators and remind them of this, because I think many of them know this intuitively, that cues, like the position they take on something, matter a lot for public opinion. That can help tell members of the public what policies they should think about supporting. And I'll connect that a little to what that means for specific CCL work at the end. All right, on to the sort of second big piece here. So we started out saying that it's not entirely clear whether people really value bipartisanship in practice. So I actually set out to test this in my research. So I used two different studies in which in each of them I had an article about a bill being debated in Congress. It was an article I created, but it was meant to be pretty realistic as to the type of policy options that are often discussed in Congress. In each case, the article focused on a complicated policy issue. In one case, it was unemployment. In another, it was immigration. And it was bills that were sort of plausible as bipartisan bills or bills that could be sponsored by either party. So I was using fairly non-controversial policies. For unemployment, that looked like more funding for education grants and also some tax breaks for businesses that hired the long-term unemployed. And so the goal of these studies in both cases was I was trying to distinguish how much people cared about bipartisan cooperation, whether a bill had bipartisan support versus if it was supported by either party. And I was trying to distinguish that from whether people cared about legislators sort of taking a more civil tone with each other or an uncivil tone, and whether the bill passed or failed. So does it really matter who is supporting a bill, quite aside from how the tone of debate is or whether that bill ends up passing? So what I found through this, through these studies, is that it really does matter if there's a bipartisan coalition supporting a bill. So first, people have a lot more confidence in Congress when that bill has bipartisan sponsorship. So they like Congress better as an institution. Also, thinking about how people feel about the specific bill, I found that that bill gets the same amount of support and is seen as ideologically similar to a bill when it's supported by your own party. And that's important because even if you look at the exact same bill, the same policy content, if it's described as being sponsored just by the other party, people are less likely to support it. They see that bill as more ideologically extreme. So to sort of put this another way, people assume that bills that are sponsored only by the opposite party are bad. So if you're looking at a partisan bill where support is coming really almost entirely from one party, you're basically losing up to half the population because they're skeptical that that bill would be a good idea because they're getting this signal that this would not be good for people like them. So I also looked at how people evaluated the specific legislator. So do they like a specific legislator better when that person engages in bipartisan cooperation? And I saw that certainly voters from the opposite party like the legislator better, and voters from the same party are fine with it. There's no penalty there for bipartisan cooperation. There's one exception to that, which I saw that minority voters on the immigration bill were skeptical of bipartisan cooperation. So I think potentially if there are some specific personal connections to the issue or specific trade-offs people are worried about, they can be more skeptical of bipartisanship. But I think on sort of a broad-based bill, something like carbon fee and dividend, you're really unlikely to see much penalty from same party voters. Voters also, when that legislator acts in a bipartisan way, they think, okay, that's someone who's listening to the views of voters. That's someone who's listening to other representatives. And they're less likely to see that person as self-interested, which is important because many people tend to think that all legislators are very self-interested. So that's really the second lesson. Bipartisanship really benefits a legislator's reputation. And it also increases the public support for the policy that is getting bipartisan support. So let me just in the last minute or two here really tie this to the work of CCL and the work you all do. So when you're talking to a legislator about why they should join the Climate Solutions Caucus, when you're talking about why they should support carbon fee and dividend, I think there are two things you can really highlight. I mean, one is that there are very real benefits to their reputation by acting in a bipartisan way and joining this bipartisan caucus. It's a great way for them to gain appeal from crossover voters from the opposite party without risking a loss from their own party. Additionally, with carbon fee and dividend, they are associating themselves with a policy that we know is popular. When people learn more about it, when they have more information about it, they like it. So this is a really good way for legislators to be seen as sort of problem solvers, which we know voters are looking for. The second big takeaway is that in addition to those benefits to the legislator's reputation, there's also very real benefits to sort of the public good and the common good. So joining the caucus actually is creating cues for people. It's telling people this is a policy that this legislator supports and people from both parties support. That sort of reinforces the public recognition that this is a real problem we need to address. Like, climate change is real, it's a problem, and that we can do something about it. And if you think about it, a legislator coming out and saying, I support carbon fee and dividend, sort of acts as a cue in two different ways. One, it says, okay, anyone who supports this legislator or anyone who affiliates with this party, that's a clear position cue for you. This policy is good for people like me. There's also the bipartisan cue, right? This is a policy that has bipartisan support, and that gives the public more confidence. Even though they already like the policy ideas, that gives them even more confidence. Yes, this is a good idea, and this is something we should do. So legislators should be aware that they're helping themselves by engaging in a bipartisan caucus like this, and they're also helping the cause. So they should feel good about what they're doing and be comfortable that they can do it and benefit from it. So I think that's a strong argument to potentially be making when you're having these conversations with them. And thank you so much for listening. And I'd be love to take any questions you might have.
Great. So Dr. Paris, I'll ask Brett to pull a couple of questions out of the chat in just a second. But one of the things that it seems like you said is, in particular, for Republicans that join the caucus, when they speak up about the need to do something to address climate change, that affects the public's perception.
Yes, absolutely. Because I think, you know, it's dangerous when a huge problem that affects all of us and the entire future of our planet is seen as something that somehow belongs to one party, is seen mm-hmm. as something that, you know, you shouldn't support or you should be skeptical of if you're a good Republican. So I think when Republicans speak out about this, they're really transforming that perception and making it possible for people to say, yes, we should all be worried about this. And this is frankly a solution that is compatible with both liberal and conservative values.
Are there a question or two from the chat that you'd like to pick?
Let me see if I can, I'll pull myself off the share screen here and pull the chat back open. All right. Yeah, partisan media, how that fits in the picture. That is the elephant in the room. I think that's important for legislators to think about, right? Is that obviously, especially on the Republican side, you do have some right-wing media that can be sort of, it can push back really hard if they perceive a given legislator to be backing away from conservative principles. So I think there are sort of two different ways to think about that. One is there's still a lot of other media out there, right, where you're going to get very positive media coverage. That you can sort of publicize yourself on your website. But two, I think there are conservative outlets that I think would be open to seeing this as really going along with some conservative values, invoking free market principles in certain ways. And I think that's really a case that you can actually make, that given that this is happening, given that we are experiencing climate change, this is probably a solution that's more friendly to conservative principles than a lot of the other ideas out there. And that even from, and I think many, you know, the more you can get sort of conservative intellectuals or Republican identifying sort of media personalities to recognize that and support it, the more space that will create for the legislators as well. But that's also the case that legislators themselves can start making that case to conservative media outlets. So it is, I mean, I do think having so much partisan media can create challenges, but I think some of these CCL policies offer a real way to start chipping away at some of that resistance.
Cool. Do you have one more that you'd like to take there?
Yeah, so let's see. These are all... great questions, honestly. So, I won't be able to get to all of these today, but for anyone who wants to jump on the call next Thursday, I would love to dive into all of these in a lot more depth. So I really hope you can join us then. So I would say the question about, do the results even apply to activists and partisan voters? So when I actually looked at sort of strong partisans, specifically people who say they strongly identified with the party, I'm still in most cases not seeing statistically significant negative impacts. Now, the most activist and partisan of voters, you know, that might be a very small percentage of my sample, it's possible that those people can react negatively to sort of any form of bipartisanship. So I can't rule that out. But I do think, that's important for legislators to realize, like, how many more people are either comfortable with it or would actively support them. And I think, you know, one of the CCL strategies that I think is helpful in this regards is getting other respected people in the community, people from a wide range of walks of life, a wide range of political views, to sort of sign up for to support the carbon fee and dividend, to speak out about this problem. Again, that's helping to create the space and to say, listen, if there are people who are skeptical of bipartisanship or of these specific climate policies, this is really it's a shrinking number of people. So I think to some extent, some of these organizing strategies are actually designed to continue sort of to continue making it easier for and to help people recognize that it is really a small minority, even if it's a loud minority, that is sort of opposed to this kind of problem solving.
Great, great. Well, thank you again. This was so great having you on the call today. And as you mentioned, and Brett put in the chat, and then Ricky just shared on the screen, you'll be back for questions on CCLU next Thursday night, which we're very excited about. And Brett's capturing all the additional questions that come in, because there's obviously a lot of things that we'd love to have a chance for you to get to. So thank you so much.
Thank you. And I'm so excited to talk about these questions. So I really hope to see all of you on Thursday as well. Thank you so much for having me on.
Great. I'm sure you'll have a ton of us. All right. Thank you again, Dr. Paris. Okay. So, last month we opened the international conference and over 300 people have already registered. One of the questions that people have been asking is, will we be doing the boot camp in front of before the conference again? And yes, we will be having a boot camp that won't open until March. But for those of you who've been wondering, are we doing the advanced policy boot camp in advance of the conference? Yes, we are doing that. I want to mention one other thing about our international division also. I mentioned earlier that Kathy Orlando started a chapter in Madagascar. It's just, we're so excited to be there. The other side is that one of the things that Joe Robertson has been arguing for on the international front with all the COP meetings is that citizens should be involved because the COP meetings are the most elite of elite people. And so, you know, what about citizen involvement? And one of the things we're very excited about is in the upcoming round of talks, there's going to be something called the Talanoa Dialogue. The Fijian word Talanoa means everyone in the dialogue, regardless of status or influence, is a peer of everyone else. So I'm not entirely sure how that will completely work out, but this is something Joe's been arguing for, is citizen engagement, citizen involvement on the international process is an important piece. And as you know, Joe never phases to amaze us with his ability to kind of insert himself in the middle of the international process and say, I belong here. My daughter, Katie, has a master's degree in literature, and she's also bilingual. I had a Pablo Neruda poem on my desk for a while, and one day Katie walked by and she read it, and she said, this is a really good translation. Who translated the poem? The answer, of course, was Joseph Robertson. What does he not do? In addition to inserting himself, here he is translating Pablo Neruda poems. All right, I want to talk about the actions a little bit. In Canada, we'll be focusing on Earth Day, and then there's some Ontario-specific. So there's in the action sheet, you'll see all the Canadian actions. There's three things we have on the U.S. action sheet. First of all, Spring Lobby Drive is going to be on top of us any day now. You'll see in the action sheet, there's tips for how to get the meeting, how to plan the meeting, who you should bring. And what we'll target on is the time when we know members will be back in district. You know, there's lots of times where we get the office agrees to a face-to-face meeting when we're in DC, but they get called away for a hearing. And so, sorry, Elizabeth, I don't remember which poem it is, but I'll bring it to the LA conference. So anyway, Spring Lobby Drive gives us a very good chance to get face-to-face meetings because they're in district and we got a high percentage last year. So that I'm going to be sharing with you a short video called Undo Your Part in just a minute. And so we're going to be asking people to share that. And then the communication exercise really has to do with, you know, one of the crazy things that's happening is, you know, we've got 35 Republicans and 35 Democrats on the Climate Solutions Caucus now. And that doesn't make everybody happy. So some people think that they're greenwashing, and so they attack the caucus and they attack us. And I don't think anybody likes that. So we put a communication exercise in there of how do you deal with it when people criticize what you're doing. And so I'm happy about that exercise. I want to introduce Leslie Beatty in just a moment. Leslie is our marketing director. You know, when we went through the process of distinguishing our six values, and I think that that's really one of the most powerful things we have on our website now is, you know, focus, optimism, relationships, integrity, personal power, and being nonpartisan. That's something where Leslie did this remarkable job of making something obvious that was true about the organization, but hadn't been made obvious until Leslie's work with us. She's also been doing a project with a group of volunteers in Texas. And so they're CCL volunteers, but they also actually have a marketing background. Personally, I've always believed that a message that is optimistic and patriotic has a chance of reaching people that we haven't been really successful reaching. So for instance, last year as an organization, we added somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 additional people who identify as conservatives to the organization. And that's important and it's significant, but we would like to increase the pace of that. So this video, which you'll see in a minute, and Leslie will introduce, and she'll introduce her team, really is about, you know, times where we as Americans have stepped up and faced big challenges. It's not that we've solved every big problem we've ever dealt with. It's not that the issues that it raises are handled or done. It really is, I think, a video that will remind all of us that in many cases where there were really big problems, we were willing to step up and face those problems. And I think it gives us a chance of reaching some people we haven't been able to reach by its kind of positive, which is, you know, optimism is one of our core values, and also its patriotic theme. So Leslie Beatty, if we could unmute you, and if you could introduce this and introduce your team, that'd be great. Morning, Leslie.
Hi, good morning, everyone. And it's nice to meet everyone virtually. I look forward to working with everyone. I'm very excited to introduce Undo Your Part. And I want to say a little bit about how it came into being. So as Mark has alluded to, I have always thought that the main challenge for me, and I'm a marketer, is solving climate change is a huge marketing challenge. Right? It's a complicated thing. We could solve climate change today, but we haven't. And there are a lot of reasons for that. And those reasons are entirely about humans and how we think about problems and how we get motivated to work on problems. And I've always thought to myself, we need the greatest marketers we can find working on solving climate change. And CCL being CCL, we happen to have some great marketers who came to the table. Both of them are from the Dallas, Texas area. So I want to introduce them to you and they're going to share a little bit about the creative vision. First is Carter Keith. Carter runs a marketing and branding agency in Dallas and he's here with Kevin Sutton. Kevin Sutton is a highly elusive creative director, which is the thing everybody wants. And these guys are experts at figuring out, you know, human motivation and finding ways to hook people in. They've worked for major brands. You know, they've done work on behalf of McDonald's, any sort of major brand you can think of. And lo and behold, they're willing to put the skill set to work for our cause because they are supporters and they're CCL volunteers. And so they came to us and said, you know, can we do a project? And we talked and the result today we're going to introduce, it's a video. We would like for you, if you like the video, to go to CCL's Facebook page. We've shared it there. You can make a comment and you can share it with your network if you're so moved. And we're doing, we have a hashtag strategy, and the hashtag is Undo Your Part. And the way we're asking people to post is to give a reason why you want to undo your part. So for example, I will be posting, you know, because I want to leave this place nicer than I found it, hashtag Undo Your Part. But I will hand it over to Carter to explain how the video came into being.
Great. Thanks very much, Leslie. It's much as Mark said, you know, there's a patriotism that we wanted to tap into. You can't reason why. Everybody's talked to a denier and tried to give them facts, and it doesn't get them anywhere. So what we wanted to do was lift up and have that positive emotion and make people feel this cause. And I'm a strategist and a marketer, but Kevin Sutton is an award-winning creative director. So we teed it up to him, and he wrote this script. So, Kevin?
Yeah, I really want to jump on the back of what Carter was saying, that, you know, everything we do here is, everything we do from a marketing standpoint should have a strategic underpinning to it. I kind of call it the Constitution. You don't violate from the Constitution, you don't deviate from that. And our platform, after we did a bunch of research, was Be the Change. We just felt we needed to tell people that, you know what, be the change. You can do this. I think Mark alluded to it a second ago, but really, you know, not just some, are we marketers, but we're also humans. And, you know, we started thinking about what is it that is keeping people from doing something. And I think it's this feeling that they're overwhelmed. This is an overwhelming problem. What can I, one person, do? Like we said earlier, we're not going to convince the deniers. They're not going to change their minds. And also, really don't need to talk to the people who already believe in it, because they're already there. So there's that middle ground of people who probably just need to be nudged, to remind it, hey, you can do this. And that's really what it's all about. And we're talking about, you know, about doing your part and all that. And really, it was just a creative leap. We had this idea we thought was kind of interesting. Instead of doing your part, it's undoing your part. And you're like, what is that supposed to mean? Well, that's kind of what the video explains. But it just really talks about all the things that we as Americans have done when we come together and said, wait, that's not right. And every one of those at the time was just as overwhelming. Every one of those at the time was, we'll never solve this. I'm one person. I can't do that. Well, yes, you can if we come together and we don't just do our part, but we undo our part. That's it.
Great. All right, Ricky.
We undid tyranny. We undid callousness and hopelessness. We undid evil and evil's evil twin. We've come a long way. We undid impossible and impossibly impossible.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
We undid indignity and carelessness. Just look at all we've undone. Certainly, we can undo overwhelming. It's time to undo climate change. Undo your part. There's a simple, bipartisan solution to climate change Congress needs to hear about. Go to undoyourpart.com.
All right, everybody. You know, as we always say, everything interesting, everything important, everything that significantly moves us forward always happens with volunteers in the field. So, gentlemen and Leslie, thank you very much. You know, Leslie will get us our marching orders and let us all, everybody know what we need to do. Next month, we're going to continue on the bipartisan theme. Joan Blades, who's been leading something called Living Room Conversations about getting Republicans and Democrats together, speaking with each other, will be our speaker for next month. So everybody, thank you for all you're doing. Ricky, you want to unmute the line so that we can thank the creative team for putting this together.
And to the video.